I'm Adrian Kohler.
And I'm Basil Jones.
Thank you very much. And if you would describe, please, your particular roles in Handspring.
I'm artistic director of the company. I formed it with Basil and two other friends in 1981, and I designed and made with some assistance in Cape Town the horses for War Horse, and both Basil and myself trained the puppeteers originally and directed the show originally in London. Directed the puppets originally in London.
I'm Basil Jones, also one of the founders of the company, and I am the producer in the company and normally would be a performer, but in the case of War Horse, one of the puppetry directors.
Can you describe a little bit the tradition of this particular type of puppetry? I believe that it is Japanese, is that correct?
Well, we have a range of traditions that we draw on, really. We don't have a tradition in South Africa that is a South African tradition. Certainly the Bunraku is a great inspiration for us, always has been. And Adrian, how would you talk about the other traditions?
The Bunraku of Japan is a major influence. When I myself, I was influenced by my mother, who was a puppeteer, and grew up making string puppets or marionettes. But I met Lily Hertzberg in the 70s, who had connections with the rod puppeteers of Central Europe. And she said, the rod puppet is a much more appropriate puppet for Africa. It is more gestural, it's more vibrant, it's more vigorous, and you can make strong sideways movements with it rather than the vertical movements and the softer movement that the marionette can achieve. And the other major influence is the tradition, the Malian puppetry tradition of West Africa.
Does this particular type of puppetry lend itself particularly well to inhabiting the spirit and bodies of animals?
I think it does. Well, in that, in the case of the horses, we are right inside the horses. There are two puppeteers inside the horse. So we indeed inhabit the puppet.
Their roles are the front person is the head manipulator who's outside. The person in the chest, or the heart role that we call it, is in the front end of the horse. And the hind manipulator works the rump and the tail and the hind legs. So each person has a huge responsibility in animating their particular part of the horse, but all three of them have to work as a complete team who can't talk to one another because they're all mic'd for their horse noises. So they have to almost instinctually know what the other people are going to be doing at any one particular time.
I have interviewed now two of your puppeteers, and each of them has said the thing he finds most satisfying is that when it's working well, the team cannot tell which person has generated the movement. Oh, was that something you intended?
We love to hear that. there's something quite special, quite unique, I think, in the way the three people work together. That intuition of movement, it's a little bit like three dancers that are working together on stage. You can't talk to one another, and yet you try to keep the puppet unpredictable on every night in every performance. It's really important that the human beings on stage, the cavalry officers themselves, don't really know what the horse is going to do. And that unpredictability is something that can only be coherent if all three puppeteers are working together.
The process starts in the training. The horse gaits, the walking and the trotting and the galloping all have a sequence in which the hooves land on the ground. And as soon as the puppeteers get that sequence right, the sound of the horse walk is convincing and the look of it is convincing. And they also have rehearsed it and drilled it into their psyches, if you like, over a period of time so that it does become instinctual.
What's completely convincing to me, I'm a competitive rider, is that you get that combination of lightness and heaviness, which is what, in fact, when you're training as a rider, you are told to try and achieve. It's really hard. And that's what you got. That's in the elevation, the suspension. How much help did you have from people in the professional riding community? Or what did you do to really get to understand that as well as you did?
We had remarkably little help from real riders, actually, and you've given me a good idea for possible future versions of the show and possible future training processes. But we certainly went to riding schools. We went to cavalry officers. We spent time, lots of time with horses, and lots of time watching Monty Roberts videos, reading books, going to museums, looking at horse skeletons and studying horse skeletons. And indeed, that's really where Adrian started with the design of the puppet, was the skeleton, the interrelation of the various limbs of the horse. That's where the naturalism comes from.
Yeah, if you make the legs the right length, and all the bones, allude to the bone structure of the horse, then the legs actually swing in the same way that a real horse leg swing, and the look then is convincing.
Did you look at the Da Vinci pictures as well? He has some very famous, beautiful horse pictures.
You know, we've plundered art history.
Everybody. But then, of course, there's this whole business of the psyche. And it's interesting that you mentioned Monty Roberts, of course, a celebrated horse whisperer.
Mm.
Is that where you got some of the understanding of simply how they think?
Definitely. You know, the thing about never making eye contact, that the horse finds that threatening, that has informed whole scenes in the play. We also spoke to a farm in Tunbridge Wells, in England, where they preserve ancient horse breeds, great big cart horses and working horses and various smaller breeds, and we got lovely stories from them. We were looking for whether horses formed relationships with other horses in a stable situation, and this one guy who was looking after the horses, he said there were two horses stabled together, and the one kept bashing the other one against the wall, and they thought they'd going to have to separate these two. They're far too aggressive. But then the horse that was being bashed against the wall one day had a heart attack and collapsed on the floor. And what they realized was that the horse that was they thought was bashing against the wall was actually supporting the horse against the wall, trying to keep it standing.
And you translate that scene in Warhorse.
Yes, we use that scene. It was a very valuable story.
It is, of course, one of the other things that makes the show so moving is that the relationship between the two horses is every bit as acute and powerful and completely comprehensible as the relationship between Joey and Albert.
Hmm. It's one of the new offers, I think, of puppet theatre, being able to depict animals in relationship to peoples on stage and in relationship to one another. It's something that hasn't been done very much, really, to bring our lives with animals into the theatre, and it's something that puppetry can do particularly well.
I think it's an interesting time for that, and I'm sure you've noticed that we've moved fairly acutely as a society from thinking of these the way that one German character does, as beasts of burden or something to us,
mm-hmm.
into thinking them of what's normally called companion animals now, mm. people who are our friends.
They're part of our lives.
Well, the First World War was the war that eradicated horses from cities, really. Mm-hmm. It was the coming age of the machine and the experiment with huge new machines that basically changed the nature of cities and took horses right out of our lives. But up until then, they had been very much part of human existence for thousands of years. So I think that deep down we have a very special relationship to that animal.
So in fact, the war, of course, which killed, I believe, nearly a million horses, yeah. could have made them virtually extinct for us, and it was the bond that pulled us back to them in some ways.
Mm. Well, this particular farm in Tunbridge Wells, when you ask the guy why are they keeping this farm, why have these animals, he said, well, petrol's not going to last forever.
Now that's a consoling thought. Take me back again to the process of building the puppets, because I talked to Mervyn Miller last night and he was describing some of your earlier rehearsals, which I have to say sounded a little to me like the Wright brothers. Let's try that again. It broke. So where did you begin with that? And you start with part of the structure, and then you get somebody in it and say, try doing something, and what happens?
Well, the first test was whether two actors could support a rider on some kind of a bridge between their backs. And we placed a ladder between two people, and we put a cushion on, and somebody straddled the ladder, and we found it was possible. But this ladder was resting on the shoulders of the people, and in order to, and that meant that their heads were sticking through the holes in the ladder, which was not a very good aesthetic arrangement for a horse. So we had to raise the ladder, if you like, and support it on backpacks, which raised the center of gravity, and we really didn't know whether that would work. We put our neighbor's daughter on the ladder at home in Cape Town. She was a little terrified because it was high, but we did find that we were able to hold her up. And so the horses were built around that concept.
And then it took just a lot of trial and error to get the weight and placement right.
That's right, yeah. We built a prototype, took the prototype to England, tested it with actors, found that the riding it was quite possible, and that rearing it. There were quite a number of modifications we had to make to that prototype. Initially, I was trying to drive the head from inside the horse because I was mindful that the National Theatre might not be able to employ three actors to make one character, which a horse requires. They might find it, you know, particularly when we have 10 horses on the stage, that we have 30 people needed to manipulate them. So I tried to design a two-person horse, but very soon we needed an external head manipulator. And various physiotherapists came in to look at the prototype, and they said, yeah, these front legs are fine. They work, they make their legs move all right, but within a week or so, there will be probably permanent damage to the wrists of the people working them. So I had to redesign them, change them 90 degrees from the original orientation to make it simpler.
And is there somebody looking from the outside saying, yes, it's moving, but it's not a horse, or do you yourselves pull back?
Well, this was the interesting thing about Warhorse. It was the first time for Adrian and I to move out of the puppets and cross the footlights into the theatre and look back at what we'd been doing for the last 30 years. It was really a revelatory experience for us to be able to see the work and comment on the work and nurture the work from the outside for the first time. We felt we had so much to give that we hadn't really been able to give when we were inside the puppets.
Yeah, when you're inside, you're dealing with your own character only. Mm-hmm. But here we had a complete overview, which was fantastic.
You know? And a normal theatre director, in other words, someone who's not a puppeteer, doesn't really know how to ask for what's possible and doesn't know what really is possible from the puppet. We were able to be far more demanding than a normal director would be. And I think part of the reason why the puppet manipulation, the quality of the puppet manipulation is as it is that we knew how to ask the questions of the puppeteers that could be answered and could be where they could deliver to us in a way that hadn't been done before.
Yeah, although the puppet, the horse movement looks natural, it is also fairly artificial in the sense that in order to see a thought change in the horse, you have to freeze a moment slightly, mm-hmm. allow the audience to see the change of thought before it moves on again. And those are the kind of details that we ask from our puppeteers.
So it's rather like anatomizing our own sense of how we interpret movement.
That's right.
We kind of saying quite radically, movement is thought.
Yes.
We kind of saying thought exists in the body, in the way the body moves. It's not, thought doesn't just come out of the mind. It comes out of the way we move. That's a particularly radical position. But it's not such a radical position when you apply it to a horse. I think it's more comprehensible when you apply it to a horse. And in fact, the only way to understand a horse's thoughts is to look at the horse's movements. I'm talking about thoughts and emotions, but thoughts included. And you see those thoughts happening in the way the horse moves. So all the movement possibilities that Adrian built into the horse, the way the tail twitches, the way the ears move, those are thought indicators. They're emotional indicators. And we were very conscious of helping to teach the puppeteers how to use them effectively and not to overuse them, because
we give them an exercise where we want to see a thought start in the nose and go via the ears down the mane across the heart of the horse to the tail. We want to see the We want to see the ripple effect of a thought through the body of the horse.
And yet not have it come out looking like Disney.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that, I suspect, is how you can manage the thing that is kind of the piece of leisure demand there, which is you have a prey animal operated by a predator, and
yes.
yet they perfectly understand.
Mm, that's a good way of putting it. A prey animal operated by a predator.
They've developed their own script, their horse language script. They think of the human beings outside of them as monkeys who make incomprehensible sounds, and their language is not really. But when the monkeys outside get agitated, the horse knows it should move away.
The vocalizations are also very striking and moving. And how did you arrive at some of those? The way they breathe in time, and when Joey virtually goes mad in No Man's Land,
he is
almost speaking.
We were very aware right from the beginning that that was a huge challenge to be able to produce sounds that horses make.
A horse has an enormous lung compared to ours, so we can't approximate it with one human voice.
So all three puppeteers have to together create the capacity of one horse, set of horse lungs.
Some people start in the high note and some people end on the low note. And so you feel also the same ripple of the vocal as you do with the body.
So once again, something that feels extremely organic and real, but is in fact very, very carefully orchestrated.
It's carefully orchestrated and carefully timed, because you've got to be right on top of one another, but not overlapping, in order for that sound to sound like one continuous sound from a horse.
The eyes, of course, are also particularly striking. Could you describe the material?
I'm glad you like the eyes. A lot of thought went into them. I knew that although the bodies and the heads are quite abstract, they're made out of cane and see-through fabric, the eyes are the portal into the head of the animal, and they have to draw you in as an audience. They're cast in two sections and made out of clear resin. The iris part is painted beforehand, and then a clear lens is cast over that penetrates deep into the eye in the middle. So light can flash around in the eye, but to animate it, and it has a very highly polished surface that's polished and then lacquered so that it's as shiny as possible.
You mentioned the fact that the horse is slightly abstract in structure. What made you decide not to, in fact, simply create a fully solid animal for them to get inside of? There is something about this that almost feels like an architectural drawing until it moves.
I suppose, you know, it is a theater animal. In the theater, the beauty about working in the live theater is that you can use part for the whole. You can suggest something with a gesture rather than the fully fledged object. And I think, you know, the horse is very much like a three-dimensional drawing made out of cane lines. But it's not only aesthetic, it is very practical, it's lightweight, it's flexible, and the puppeteers inside have a 360 degree view of the world through the see-through skin, which is vital for them because they're acting against other characters in the show. They have to be able to see them. If they were a solid, more naturalistic horse, where you couldn't see out in that way, they would be blind inside.
And of course, horses actually think a lot through their skin, particularly thoroughbreds.
Yes, that's
right. Because it's so fine.
Yes.
Did you find that the human actors needed some time to begin to behave naturally around your creations? I noticed very sweetly that when they came out for the bows, one of the actors just casually patted the horse on the rump, just as you would with any animal. And I remember years ago, Jim Henson's widow saying that guests on The Muppet Show would forget after about 2 minutes that the pig to whom they were speaking was not real.
That's true.
It is a process, and it comes to some people more naturally than others. Some people interact very warmly with the puppets, and some people find it quite strange and difficult. So I think it depends on the actor as to how they approach the animals.
You know, what we did do in the training of the humans was we had to say, this isn't a real horse. It doesn't have the feel of fur or the hide of a horse. It's got these lumpy, bumpy cane lines. And when you touch it, you have to describe the skin that isn't there to the audience in the way you stroke this animal. You know, when you run your hand over the beautiful flesh of a horse, you sense in the warmth of the blood and the muscles underneath the skin. Now, that isn't there. They have to describe that to the audience with their own hands. So there's a degree of miming going on. Their responsibility is to fill in the gaps that the cane can't provide.
The place that most struck me, in fact, was when Emily is currying Joey.
Yeah.
Because that's a motion that's all about texture and skin. And I thought, how incredibly good that looks.
Yes. Mm.
Well, the result, of course, is that when he gets caught in the barbed wire, every person in the audience is rigid with agony for him because they've done this so well.
They know that there's skin even though there isn't.
Exactly. What would you say is the thing that most surprised you in creating this? Something you discovered about horses, something you discovered about people, something you discovered about war?
I think the genius of the story is that Michael Morpurgo, it's in the heart of the novel, is that the horse enters a war completely neutral. It's a living, breathing, warm-blooded, loving animal that doesn't take sides. Like the humans, all instantly are enemies with one another from the opposing sides in the war. But the horse... It loves anybody who gives it attention and cares for it. And the neutrality that it is by very nature, cast into a war situation, makes the war seem so ludicrous.
I think for me, the thing that was truly remarkable in War Horse was the result of the camaraderie between the three puppeteers that manipulate each of the horses. There's something transcendent about that that we didn't expect to see. And when they're working with real restraint, the transformation of this object into a living animal is so complete. It has a real transcendent, mystical quality that took me completely by surprise and still brings tears to my eyes when I watch them on stage.
I was afraid it was going to be hard to conduct this interview because I saw the show only last night, and if I think about some things, I just want to start to cry. But I wanted to end on a merrier note, which is that there were moments when everybody, wretched and moving as they were almost upstaged by the goose, who is amazing. The articulation of her head, she's just hilarious. She's like a character actress.
Well, the goose came because when we visited farms in Devon at the very beginning of the process, there was always a dog on the farm. And the one puppet I didn't want to make was a dog because it's got a wagon tail, four legs, a head and two ears, and you've got to bend. It's a low creature. So I thought a goose is also a good watchdog on a farm, and we did see quite a number of geese. Let's have a goose as the farm watchdog. And fortunately, the director, Tom, agreed to the goose. And I grew up with geese in the village that was my home. There were always geese that swam in the river, and they were aggressive, they were grumpy, and they used to chase children.
Well, you have honored them beautifully. Now, I imagine the only challenge of having an extraordinarily successful production is what next?
The really wonderful thing is that we are able to do so many things that we might not have been able to do without the financial support of War Horse. One of them is a project in the rural areas in South Africa where we're working with young children, teaching puppetry to them in a situation where they are very isolated from any town. They never get out of the village. And it's a form of expression that I think can be very powerful for people who don't have a very strong sense of self and strong sense of their own affect in the world.
Yeah, that's a wonderful offshoot. We also are making horses in Cape Town in a factory now because the show is going to open in Toronto as well. And
so you have a breeding program.
Yes, we've got a stud farm in an industrial site. And we do have other projects, but you know how theatre people are. It can be unlucky to talk about them too soon.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.